You're listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information, visit abc.net.au/conversations. Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. Jan Murray is my guest today. Jan Murray grew up in the working class suburbs of the 1950s in Australia, and she fought like hell for a bigger life than the one that was laid out in front of her. Jan's life is like so many women from that time and place, only faster, richer, and more exciting, and at times it was sadder and madder too. Jan Murray will, of course, always be known for revealing on 60 Minutes that she'd had a sexual encounter with her husband, who was a cabinet minister at the time, on his desk in Canberra. But there is so much more to Jan's story than that one moment, of course. Jan Murray was born almost entirely deaf and learnt to lip read, but that didn't stop teachers punishing her for inattentiveness. When Jan met the charismatic John Brown, they both lied about their age, and she had five kids before she was 30. She even won the Lovely Motherhood Quest of 1972. Jan Murray fought to get herself a decent education and to be there for her husband and her kids. She ran a successful PR company for a while, but then her life went badly off the rails. Jan tells the whole story in her memoir, which is called Sheer Madness, Sex, Lies and Politics. Hello, Jan.
Oh, hello, Richard. I'm still pinching myself. I'm on the great Richard Feidler show. You know, I program my day around the conversation hour, meetings and coffee breaks.
Oh, that's nice to hear you say that. I've been wanting to get you on this program for ages. So this is good timing all round,
lovely,
I think.
Lovely, lovely.
You won the Lovely Motherhood Quest of 1972.
Do you know, it was weird. I'd read Germaine Greer the year before, and I was a militant feminist. Man, I was flat out. I'd moved into flowered hats and long white glove territory with the Lovely Motherhood Quest at a time when I was flat out keeping my bra on under my Che Guevara T-shirt. They didn't know what had hit them. I think I got the sympathy vote for having five kids, and they were just nonplussed. I just talked at them all the time about feminism.
The picture of you in there is amazing from 1970. It's got the old Channel 10 logo on there, and there you are holding up one of your baby boys.
Yes, who turned 39 yesterday. Happy birthday, Julian.
And, you know, you're gorgeous, you look fantastic, and you've got an exciting, interesting husband. You look like the woman who's doing it all, like she's able to somehow take care of everything.
That was 1972, yeah. That was a good time. That was a good time. Yeah, I was coping. I was an amazing coper. You know, multitasking, as we women are hotwired to multitask, and I did all that, helped husband into politics and did the kids, wrote the plays for their school, and then said, I need an education. One morning I woke up and I said to my mum, here are some kids. Can you look after them? Because I'm off to university. You know, this is a mum who just didn't understand, who'd sent me off to a home science school when I was 11 or 12 and just didn't know why a married woman, happily married to the most beautiful man who could afford to keep her, had five beautiful children, suddenly mum said, cake decorating, glass blowing, you know, the interior decorating. No, mum, I want to do political science, English literature.
Glass blowing. I love that. That's a proper occupation for a woman, isn't it? Glass blowing. You describe yourself in your book as a bugger of a kid. How so? What do you mean?
Oh, an emotional hooligan, I think, when I look back. I used to have this terrible feeling of alienation that I didn't belong. You know, adopted. We all think we're adopted, but I really believed it because these people who are my family, sometimes I loved them dearly and other times they were monsters from out of space. I had no feeling for them. I didn't think there was any reason in getting up in the morning. And my mother would say, go into your room, young lady, and sulk. Come out when you want to be part of the family. Or if I was doing something crazy, you know, excitable, and she'd say, oh, forget her, she's just highly strung. So that was as a child. But I think it was always a chemical imbalance because up until the age of two or three, I threw convulsions. And that was to do with the lack of They said sugar. I used to have lots of lemonade and ice cream and glucagon. I mentioned it in the book, this glucagon powder.
I remember that.
Yeah. Do you remember glucagon? Mm. Blue and black tins of glucagon over everything because, you know, give the girl sugar, she'll be right. But the convulsions kept coming and then I was always erratic. Always erratic, you know.
You sound like that old phrase, like a ball bearing in a milk bottle, as a little girl.
A little bit like that.
Yeah, banging around, doing things.
Do you like the bit? I was always susceptible to imagery. Movies always got me. And there's a bit there I talk at the beginning of the book where I just come back from a Western movie. And I was resentful about Merrylands, my hometown. It just wasn't big enough to contain me. I knew there was a life outside of Merrylands. And
which wasn't very merry.
No, I think the Civic Fathers were having a bit of a joke when they named it. But I'm up the backyard in the chook yard. I'd built a little campfire and I'd got some of our camping plates, the old aluminium dishes. And I'm scooping the baked beans off the plate, squatting by the campfire, howdy doing to myself like the John Wayne I'd just come from. And I really pictured riding into Merryland, shooting up the teachers and the civic fathers and just riding out again. And I was nine.
Urban renewal, the politics of urban renewal at the age of nine for you. Chooks were a big part of your childhood.
Love my chooks.
And a big thing for your dad as well. Tell me how your dad persuaded you how you might get taller as a child.
Oh, yes. That's a bit of a dirty story.
Oh, okay.
Dad used to, we loved our chooks. You know, so we killed them together. He taught me how to hypnotise them first so they didn't feel any pain.
How do you hypnotise a chook?
You put, I don't know if the RSPCA, if this is approved, but it worked for us. You put the head under the wing and you turn it around seven times in a clockwork motion and the chook's hypnotised and it doesn't know it's being killed. And then we'd put its head down on the block with two big nails and just chop its head off. Then you hung it on the clothesline and then it went in the copper and pulling the feathers off was the messy part and then gutting it and the craw and all that. I mean, kids now, they think it comes ready frozen from a supermarket. I think they should be made, if they're going to eat a chook, they should be made to kill the chook.
That was, so I suppose you straddled that great dividing line between Depression era, your parents who were Depression era, and you're a baby boomer born in the age of abundance. It's a different thing. But I interrupted you. You were going to tell
how I grew taller. Well, chook manure was part of our daily life and Dad used to throw it on the garden and he grew beautiful tomatoes and beans. They grew tall. I had a girlfriend, Pammy, and Pammy and I used to have a competition. I'd grow an inch taller than her, then she'd shoot up. This is when we were seven, eight, nine. But she kept growing and I didn't, a little chunky monkey. And Dad said, well, if you go up in the chook yard and stand on a whole pile of chook manure, for every 10 minutes you'll grow an inch. Well, you believe your father when you're eight or nine, don't you?
No one knew you were a bugger of a kid. You had a bugger of a father, didn't you?
Oh, he was a torment. It was a terrible torment.
Did you mysteriously get taller anyway? I just wonder if you put that down to the chook
food. No, but as I mentioned in the book, while I'm there, I thought I may as well make this work for me. I put a little bit on my boobs, on my nine-year-old boobs, and they have not stopped growing, let me tell you.
Hear that, girls? Chook poo. That's the way to do it. We're joking, by the way. I just hasten to add that. Jan Murray is my guest today. Jan's written her astonishing memoir. It's called Sheer Madness, Sex, Lies and Politics. Jan, when did you first realise you had hearing problems?
That was a beautiful school teacher, Miss McDowell, when I was six. We used to have to say the Our Father every morning. And she happened to be near me walking past when I'm saying mine. And she stopped and said, repeat that to me, repeat it. And I said, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. And, you know, something about Devon instead of heaven. I was getting all the words wrong. And she said, okay. And she got me and started me up to the school doctor used to come then to primary school kids. And the tuning fork. And they realised I'd been working on lip reading. And that's part of what, you know, I do have attitude. I come with attitude and particularly at aggravated school teachers. And they realised I wasn't hearing them. The reason I was turning my back and walking away before they'd finished speaking to me wasn't that I was a hoity little miss. I just thought they'd finished speaking to me. That's simple. And
did that cut you any slack with your teachers, though?
I know that each new teacher, when I moved up the scale through primary and into high school, I came with form. They just thought I was this obnoxious creature that didn't respect authority. And it was just that I was getting more and more alienated from the system. It wasn't until I was a mature age student in my 30s at Macquarie University that someone gave me a person to sit next to me to interpret, because in a lecture I couldn't take notes and listen to the lecture. I could do one or the other. So they had somebody sit near me to interpret, you know, and if somebody up the back of the room asked a question, I couldn't hear it. So that was very good.
I know that bright kids who are dyslexic, who have dyslexia, they compensate for their dyslexia by having really sharp interrogative skills. They ask questions all the time and they really listen. What do you think a kid who's mostly deaf, like you were, what compensatory measures do you think you develop?
I think it's like pumping iron with your muscles. Your brain is always working, because if I'm 80% hearing impaired, then I'm only getting 20% of the message. So to understand what you're saying, I have to listen carefully to the intonation in your voice. I've got to watch your body language. I've got to read your lips. There's a whole lot more I've got to do to get 100% of the message than a perfectly good hearing person has to do. So I think it just makes you a little bit more aware. I'll tell you this, men think it's wonderful when you hang on every word they say.
Because you're staring right at them, aren't you?
They start to think first they've got spinach between their teeth. You know, you're always taught as a child to look at person's eyes when they speak to you. And I get a bit embarrassed about that, because I find my eyes dropping down to their lips. And the other thing, Aussies don't move their lips very much. You ABC people do. You have beautiful skills.
Yes, we get whacked over the head on a daily basis if our lips don't move properly. It's like, sit there. No one really knows
keep
that
it
about
going.
The ABC. That's right. But you were actually treated quite cruelly on one occasion by one of your teachers.
Oh, yeah, a couple of the teachers. One slapped me across the face with a ruler. I'd had 3 days off with a supurating eardrum, infected ears. Brought the note from class. That was all right. I'd caused them to, there was a competition about perfect enrolment, perfect attendance, and I'd caused 5A to lose their perfect attendance record. She was very angry with me. And I didn't hear what she said, because she turned her back, and by then she was walking up the corridor, up the aisle. But I must have said something that upset her, because she returned and she had a green plastic ruler in her hand, and I'll never forget it. I mean, on the scale of child abuse, it's very minimal, but to me it really hurt, because we'd never had physical abuse at home. And she slapped me across the face with a ruler and it broke.
It broke?
Yeah, she broke the ruler across my face, made me pick up the pieces, and then she sent me up the back of the room, and she came back to me at the back of the room. She had thumbtacks, and the ribbons on my plaits she nailed up to the wall behind me and nailed me to the wall for two periods till the lunch bell went. So you'll apologise, and I would not apologise. I mean, that's how I came to disrespect authority, because that woman had authority over me and she was misusing it badly.
She was a sadist, possibly. Yeah. She knew you were deaf, didn't she?
Yes. Yeah, and I not only had that, but I also still had the superating ears, the earache, and I was tired through 3 nights of lost sleep. And, you know, it was just inhuman to do that.
How was your mother treating your deafness?
But if she's still around, I've forgiven her. I've let go of all the anger. I'm a Buddhist these days. I cling to nothing.
I don't know, but you've exposed. Well, you haven't mentioned her name, but she's been spoken about on radio to quite a large audience, and so that's her bad karma coming back to her.
I think so.
But how was your mum treating your deafness?
Mum was a lady who at that time smoked about 40 cigarettes a day, but she wasn't going to let her daughter have penicillin.
You know, Why not?
Well, I was born the same year as penicillin, 1942, and it was just not a lot known about it, so I don't blame Mum. But she thought it was addictive, and no daughter of hers was going to have an addictive drug. So I'm deaf instead.
Look, getting you hooked on that penicillin, young lady.
Yes.
So what did she give you, hot poultices instead?
This is incredible. She used to heat one of Dad's woolen socks. She used to put salt in one of Dad's woolen socks and heat it in the oven. Then I had to lay on that, keep it on my ear all night. Then in the morning, in would go the spoonful of peroxide after she'd heated it in the spoon. And after the peroxide fizzled all the wax, I'm sorry, listeners, this is horrible, but it was. And then in went the glycerine, and then in went the cotton wool, and off I'd go to school.
That would have damaged your hearing,
surely. Well, instead
of
the eardrum being like a thin onion skin. Mine's like a farrier's apron, you know, it's leather, it's thick leather. And everything's ossified, the hammer, anvil and drum, the three little bits you've got beating that give you the vibration. I've just all ossified in me, so I don't have any vibration. Yeah, but, you know, penicillin was new and...
So you're this kid who has trouble hearing, but you learn how to pay very close attention to what people are saying. You're a really bookish little girl too.
Yes, because no one was running interference on me with a book. I could, and we had a beautiful mulberry tree up in the Chook Yard. That was my home away from home. And I'd take the subversive literature up the back.
Like what? What kind of subversive literature?
Oh, Peyton Place. No, is there anyone old enough to remember Peyton Place? and Darwin's Passage of the Beagle and... Yeah, that was the Passage of the Beagle. That really upset Mum. She wouldn't have condoned that. But then she did condone Biggles and Sambo, Little Black Boy and all those things. They were the times.
It sounds like you weren't very much of a girly girl initially because you wanted to be a mechanic.
I did. I'd gone through the horrors of what they laughingly called an education. The state put me in when I was 11. I went into home science and learned how to... create raw starch and fold a starch table in eight. So when I flicked it out, it was just immaculate. How to stack the crockery, the cutlery, the wooden boards, the dirty pots. You know, there is a way to wash up, Richard. I don't know if you're aware of it, but I have a degree in it. And someone in the system thought this was empowering knowledge for a 14, 15-year-old girl. So that's what I had when I left school, that and a bit of bookkeeping. And it's not what I wanted to do. For years, Dad had taught me to drive when I was 13, way out in the back blocks of Merrylands. There was a big colliery out there and it was real Mad Max country, and that's where I learnt to drive. But he also made me strip the engine of our little old Ford Prefect before he let me behind the wheel. So I could. We used to pull the car apart, the engine apart, decoke it, put it back together, and I had all these manuals, his mechanics manuals, and I used to replicate them in my drawings. So I figured I knew what went on under the bonnet.
You see, these days, you'd be a dream girl. I mean, you know, a woman who can actually...
A rev head in a skirt.
Actually, because I can't fix a car to save my life.
Oh, you can't now. It's all computerised.
I know. Still, a woman who can strip down an E.H. Holden and put it back together again.
Yeah, but then I went down to Mr. Rowley at the bottom of the street, our neighbour, and with Dad. And honestly, when Dad asked him if he would apprentice me, it was like he was asking to do something indecent. It was just horrified.
It's against the law of nature.
Oh, the poor guy. You know, he finally pulled out of the tough corner. There was no toilets. He knew the reason. There were no women's toilets. So it was my plumbing and his plumbing that did me in.
That was a huge issue for women in the 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The fact that there were no women's toilets in a whole lot
we're
of workplaces.
We're talking 50s, Richard. Thank you for the compliment, but I'm talking 59.
I know, but right up until the 50s. That was 70s, your education was, you know... pretty basic, as you said, and very, very limited. I love the story about the speech you gave many years later.
The member's good lady.
The member for Parramatta's good lady. Tell me about that speech.
Well, I was an old girl of the school, and I'd proved their point. I'd married well. I'd married up. You know, here I was married to a successful businessman who was the local member for Parramatta. So they invited me back for the end of year. And it was just on the cusp of feminism. Well, no, it was 78, so, you know, we were in the thick of it. And I gave an excoriating view of that school and my education, and it wasn't all that much better. You know, jaws are dropping open. This is not what they expected
what
from
did
a
you
member's
say?
Good lady.
What did you say?
Well, I gave retention rates, poor retention rates, and I said, look, okay, so you want to be a nurse. Have you thought about being the doctor? You want to be an airline hostess? Great, fly that. But have you ever thought of flying that big silver plane through the sky? You know, and so, but there was still no pulse out there. No, it was a hot night and I'd gone well over the 6 minutes or 7 minutes I'd been told. I was well into the hour by now. And I think the poor buggers just wanted to get out of there. But
Did you lambast them for your inadequate education?
Oh, yes. But then at the end, they politely, little polite clap, and then they got up and sort of climbed over each other to get out into the fresh air. But the young teacher up on the stage with me came over and she gave me a big hug. And she turned me around to face the auditorium again. And there were a dozen young women, young girls from the year 12. And they were standing there and they just looking at each other and then slowly they started to clap. Then when they saw that each other was clapping, they're clapping above their heads and, you know, really giving me, and it was such a monumental, they believed in themselves. That's what I loved. It was them believing in their future.
I would have loved to have been there to watch that speech to see you pour a bucket on your old school.
You're from the music industry. One, as I say in the book, my son, my oldest son, who one of his dear friends was a senior executive in the music industry. And she, not he, she told Johnny that she was there. She was one of the girls, one of the 12 girls clapping that day, and it changed her life.
Jan Murray is here. She's written her memoir. It's called Sheer Madness, Sex, Lies and Politics. She took up nursing for a while. Why did you have to give it up?
Because of my hearing. I could do the study, but I wasn't much good in nurse-patient relationships and totally whacked out of it when I got into surgery, into theatre, because just imagine it, the doctors and the sisters, they have their back to you for a start and they've got masks on and I'm passing them all the wrong implements. It was no good.
Yeah, scalpel and you hand them a flashlight instead or something.
That's right.
Oh, dear. In those days, girls could either, I remember that girls were either going to be a nurse or a hostie, or a secretary.
That was it, wasn't it? Yes, that was about it. Yeah, that was it.
I don't know. I think, I mean, even when I hear that, I've got a daughter, you know, I hate the thought that my daughter would either have to be a nurse or a hostie.
It was
or
very
a secretary.
Limiting. Yep, very limiting. And they were, that was the top end. There was the factory floor.
So much of your life, of course, was with your husband, John Brown. Tell me how you met John.
Oh, it was my first real date. There were my two girlfriends, and we gave ourselves names on for the occasion. We were going to a 50-50 dance in Strathfield in Sydney. One was called Tracy, the other was called Coco, and I called myself Bambi.
Bambi.
A little deer, Bambi. God knows where I got that from, but so I was Bambi. And Bambi was dancing around and it came to interval. And I was in the arms of a young, slick-back, greasy rocker called Freddie. Freddie had a beautiful white FJ Holden parked across the road and he told me it had purple trims, double twin exhaust cams. You know, it had the lot. Would I like to come and see it? Well, of course, a girl like me wanted to see that. So I went across it was just a paddock, a parking lot with Freddie, but Freddie had other intentions. He was a lecher, Freddie the lecher. So I've hit the toe and crossed the road, ran frightened across the road. I just wanted to get out of there, grab my two girlfriends and beat it back to Merrylands. And suddenly I'm pulled up straight, this tough guy, what's the matter? You know, and I looked up and most beautiful man with beautiful blue eyes, classic features. And I just fell in love on the spot. I think it was the protective instinct. And we danced every dance from them. We danced the last dance and a dynasty was born. I was 16. He was 27. That took a lot for my mother to accept.
How old did you tell him you were?
Told him I was 19. He said he was 23. And he took me to a nightclub that night. Dad was out the front waiting at 11 o'clock to pick up Coco, Tracy and Bambi. But only Coco and Tracy were there. Bambi had gone off to a nightclub.
Where had you gone?
I didn't even know what a nightclub was. But I went into Sydney with John to a place called Spelson's, long gone now, but very, very glamorous. I think that's one of the good things people have said about the book. I've given a bit of a history of that part of Sydney, the glamour Sydney, when you'd go to the races and you'd go to the nightclubs in the evening and you'd dress up. And, all I had to talk about at the nightclub, because I'm 16, just left school, you know, 18 months ago, working in an office or something. I talked about my chooks. His dad kept chooks, so we had a lot in common.
So you had a handful of chooks, Charles Darwin, Biggles and E.H. Holdens.
And John was a very sophisticated man about town. You know, he'd taken out the glamour girls and here's this kid talking to him about the crawl, the chook.
What did your mum told you about your virginity?
Ah, it was the hardest thing to keep, the easiest thing to lose, but she said it's like, for a man, it's like interest in the bank. When he takes it out, it's lost. So, you know, keep your legs together. That was the order. That was it. I was born to be a wife and a virgin.
Did you have every intention of obeying your mum?
Oh, until hormones kicked in. I was about 16 and a half.
So you got married. You decided to get married. Yeah. But a child was on the way, wasn't it?
We were told everything was kosher. John was now accepted. We were an item, although I was still only 16. But Mum, the duenna, the guardian angel, made sure that I wasn't out late at night and all that sort of thing. And it was understood that we couldn't get married, although we knew we wanted to from the moment we met. I couldn't get married till I was 21. But, you know, nature doesn't have the same clocks as we have. And girls will be girls and boys will do the things they shouldn't do. And I was pregnant, so we had to tell all sorts of fibs. You couldn't tell. Back in 1963, you couldn't tell your parents, although you'd been engaged for 4 years, you couldn't tell your parents that you were pregnant. Just wasn't on.
Even worse than being pregnant, you had to become a Roman Catholic in your mother's ideas.
Well, I fell in. I didn't change my religion for John. When I was a nurse, 17, at the hospital, I fell in love with the Roman Catholic priest. And I had these esoteric arguments with him because I was such a proddy, such a bigoted Protestant, fighting with John with his Catholic religion for those years. I went off and bought the papal encyclicals, which is about a 6-inch tome, and read it from cover to cover so that I could argue with John about the papal doctrines for the 2,000 years. And I started to do this with the priest over the bed of a femur patient. But he had my number. He knew as much about the papal encyclicals as I did, so he arranged to see me on every second Wednesday for an intelligent discussion.
How about the femur patient? Did he say at any point, can you continue this discussion elsewhere? I've got a sore leg here. Did he do that?
Probably called for an aspirin.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today my guest in conversation is Jan Murray. Jan's written her autobiography of a very, very large life indeed. It's called Sheer Madness, Sex, Lies and Politics. So you got married to John. You agreed to...
20.
I like the fact he was your godfather at your Catholic baptism.
Yes. Yeah, well, I was in love with the priest, and in an intellectual way, but it was stimulating to be arguing with this gentleman. But then I needed... That priest disappeared and another priest came in and he had my number. You know, he said, okay, the party's over. You're either in or you're out. And so the baptism had to take place. And I was 17 and I didn't know that many Catholics. I had an auntie and I brought her in and I had to have a godfather. So John was the only Catholic that I knew. So I asked him to be my godfather. And that was fine, baptised. But 3 years later, when the little stranger's on the way and we've got to get married and bring the marriage forward, I was 20, suddenly the banns couldn't be read out because it was, spiritual incest, I think they called it. You couldn't marry your godfather. So in those days, there were no emails or texting. We had to write a letter to the Holy Father and it had to come back in all its parchment glory.
Spiritual incest sounds like the worst thing you can do.
Oh, yes.
It sounds like worse than bestiality,
doesn't
it? I
didn't enjoy it at all.
Oh, Jan. So then married life begins for you, and you had 5 kids before you were 30. And
yep. People used to say, what was it? I'd say, you've either got to be a sex maniac or a Catholic. And I'd look at John and say, he's the Catholic. No, one hoity dame in the early 70s, we were at a snooty North Shore dinner party, which I wasn't enjoying at all. I'd been arguing with them about Vietnam, Australia being involved in Vietnam. Didn't go down well on the leafy North Shore. So then this woman said to me, and you've got 5 children, you know, barked at me, you've got 5 children. And I said, I looked at her, and by now John's kicking me under the table, you know. I said, yeah, actually I had 10, but I rolled on half the litter. Well, the Chardonnay went flying, you know, the beautiful dentistry just glared, and the eyes rolled back in her smooth North Shore forehead. I just cashed in my fondue fork and got on my high dudgeon and left.
That's hilarious. Did anyone laugh? I hope they did.
Particularly not John. I was always walking out of dinner parties in the 70s.
You five kids, and And you lost a sixth. Can you tell us the story about losing the
sixth? That was very sad. And that, I think, is what radicalised me, really radicalised me. Julian, my baby, he was born in 71. And I'd gone along we used to go for a 6 weeks checkup. I think mums still do after the birth. And the doctor said to me, oh, we won't give you the pap test. You've had four, you know, you're right. But I was halfway out the door and he called me back. He said, oh, it looks bad in the record. So up I get, have the pap test. And 2 days later, the cytologist report says I've got atypical cells. So there was a few months of having biopsies and I wasn't allowed to have the pill, to go on the pill, because the same hormones, or fall pregnant, because those hormones would grow the tumour. And but I did, which was, you know, I wanted six children. That was what I was aiming for. And I think being manic, I hadn't been diagnosed at this stage, but it was in a manic phase. You feel indomitable. You can do anything. And I wanted this sixth baby. And I was pregnant. And my doctor sent me to a surgeon. And he was just so brutal. He just made the case it was me or the baby. One of us wouldn't see the full term. And, you know, I had five children. I had a responsibility. I believe now I was conned into the termination. So it was a hysterectomy and termination. And that really, really traumatised me, seriously traumatised me.
With grief?
Yeah, with anger and with grief. I mean, the hypocrisy, I've always loathed hypocrisy. The hypocrisy of the state was then that you had to have two psychiatrists sign off for an abortion. Mine was a termination. I was losing my uterus, which happened to be a fecund uterus. There was a child there. And I didn't want to lose this baby. I wanted doctors to help me get through it. But I had to submit to this hypocrisy of two psychiatrists signing that I'd be psychologically damaged if I had the child. You know, so this is the state interfering in the most intimate relationship. But then, so they signed off on that. I'm prepped for the operation. And then they realised that they have to have my husband's signature, not just as next of kin. He'd signed that for anaesthetic. But this was, he owned my uterus. Back then, the uterus was in joint names. And although I had the cancer, the tumour, I had to have my husband's permission to have the operation. So I do write, I've got a chip on my shoulder and I'm pretty angry when I write that chapter about losing my sixth baby. It was ultimately why I did my thesis, my honours thesis on Medicare and the delivery of a free for service, not fee for service, but free service, because I reckon it was the fee for service imperative that doctor ripped my uterus out. We had the highest rate of tonsillectomies, appendectomies, hysterectomies in those days before Whitlam came in and said universal health care. So
take it out was the thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You said that your thesis was that private health care was a health hazard. I had the empty arms to prove it.
That's right.
Very painful sentence to read, and it must have been much more painful to write.
Yeah, and I was told later by the psychiatrist that was one of the original losses. Depression is about loss, and my hearing was one, they claim, and losing this baby was another serious part of the loss, which led to serious depression.
Your husband got elected to federal parliament in 1977. John Brown was elected as the member for Parramatta, Western Sydney.
Yippee! We loved it. We'd been campaigning forever, but didn't quite realise what we were getting ourselves into.
These were like the darkest days for the Labor Party. The 77 election might have been good for your husband, but it was a terrible result for the Labor Party. Gough Whitlam went down to a shocking defeat.
A
lot of bitterness, and that was that. You wrote the, I love this, you researched and wrote his maiden speech in Parliament.
Yes. I realised that he was the Labor kid coming in, you know, the first Labor person for Parramatta. There'd been prime ministers and there'd been sirs, Sir Garfield Barwick, Sir Nigel Bowen, not Sir Philip Ruddock, but Philip Ruddock was the last one before John knocked him off.
And you took on a lot of causes, and I love some of these causes you took on after he got elected. Closing the Parramatta Girls Reformatory, where immoral
what
girls
a horror, were sent. What an anachronism from a lost age that was.
Girls were sent there for immoral behaviour.
Yes,
that right?
Yes, and whose morality were we using to judge it? But the terrible irony was they might have been a little bit, in parenthesis, promiscuous out there, but once they got in there, they didn't have a say about their sexuality. They were raped on very many occasions, abused, sexually abused, sent, if they rejected that, if they kicked up a fuss about that, they were sent to Hay, which was even more shocking, further away from public scrutiny.
And revelations about that centre in Hay came out many years later, didn't it? And even at a slightly more mundane level, you took on the campaign to get kids to take backpacks to school rather than those horrible old Glowbite school. I wish you'd gotten in time for me to reap the benefits of that.
I didn't mention Glowbite. You've mentioned it on the ABC. You're brave. But, yeah, they were bad. They were very bad for our posture. I was, you know, like all kids, I had to cart this heavy Glowbite school bag. And
we were teetering, weren't we? I mean, you know, with books in one arm, teetering to one side.
When your bones are still green, that's the bad thing. So, and I finished up with a little scoliosis, you know, a little twisted spine, as so many of us do. But it was just something I felt that here now I've got access to the media and people will take notice because I'm ringing from the member's office, and I got all sorts of professionals to come on side.
Tell me again about the extent of excitement there was. I mean, John, I'll go back a step first. The famous crisis between Bob Hawke and Bill Hayden in the Labor Party at the time. Bill Hayden was the leader. Bob Hawke was the challenger. John, your husband, was very much a Bob Hawke supporter.
Yes.
Very much. I mean, they were like two peas in a pod.
They were.
Men.
Well, they were mates. They were racing mates, golfing buddies. But also Hawke was supporting John's tourism ideas and sport. Obviously, they were both sports nuts.
But you liked Hayden.
I did. I respected Hayden. I didn't and still don't have a great deal of respect for Bob Hawke. I think he's a populist. Whereas I felt Hayden, and mind you, this is pre-Governor General Hayden I'm talking about, but I thought he was a man who, he didn't need popularity. He didn't need to be loved. He knew what was right. And I was very impressed with things like the Homeless Persons Act and Medicare, universal healthcare, and he took such a battering from the right wing over Medicare. You know, they alluded to his mental situation and everything, and he didn't care who withstood it. Whereas Hawkey would have just shuffled, done a bit of a sidestep, and come up with a more popular policy, I believe. Not only that, but Bill and I quoted Rilke, the German poet. We loved Rilke, and that's very 70s and very wankerish, but, you know, we did, and we had a lot of things going for us, and I just believed he'd be a better Prime Minister.
You even did him a service, didn't you, during the leadership struggle?
Yeah, I'm not sure that John Brown thinks that's a very good idea. I was the Mata Hari of the suburbs. I purloined the document that the right wing, it was the night of the long knives and all the votes were in. This was, Hawke was about to make his big move on Hayden, and I was privy to the count, and I took the document when it was no longer centre of attention, and I hot-footed it across the road to the Wellington Hotel, and I showed it to Bill, and he knew then he was a goner. And I believe that's the same document that John Button saw when he wrote the famous letter.
Encouraging Hayden to step down.
Yes, when Bill made that famous statement about the drover's dog and all that sort of thing.
So in 1983, the Hawke government got elected, and that's when your husband John became the Minister for Sport, Tourism and the Arts, I think, as well. And
Arts Territories.
Arts Territories, a whole lot of different portfolios. Tourism was his real passion.
And, yes.
And as a result, due to his efforts, we have a gigantic tourism industry.
That's right, yeah. They used to think he was a nutcase. You know, the economic journalists, and Hayden particularly as the leader at the time, wouldn't have anything to do with John's green paper that he'd written and the pronouncements he was making about the jobs that could be created. And in the first year, he created 200,000 new jobs in an industry that hadn't existed. And 2 million people came to Australia as a result of the Shrimp on the Barbie ad. So, you know, I give him a hard time for a lot of things, but he was a great minister for tourism.
The night that you mentioned on 60 Minutes famously all those years ago, the story around that's rather lovely. It was pretty much about letting his senior staff making a point that they ought to put your calls through to him, I think. And the story of that begins with the search for a hurricane lab. If you could tell me that story, I think that's rather lovely.
Oh, well, John had just became a minister, and I'd suddenly been shuffled to the burbs, you know, with the children, because before then I'd worked very closely with him in his campaigns, and nobody in Australia knew more about the tourism industry than John, his senior assistant Emmanuel Klein and myself, and yet Hawke wouldn't let me be on anybody, any ministers. I had an honours degree in political science. I'd had 20 years of loyalty campaign directors, but I had to watch the Johnny-come-latelys come in, and I was sent home to the burbs. So I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder. I was a bit you know, feisty. And this day, just after he'd become a minister, the suburb blacked out. And the kids said, "Dad knows where the hurricane lamps are." "Yeah, well, Dad's clever. Dad knows enough to be down there having a good life while I'm stuck at home with you lot." But anyway, we rang Dad, "Where are the hurricane lamps?" But the staff, "Oh, the minister's busy. The minister can't see you." And the minister's
with... You mean
with
my husband?
Oh,
yes.
The minister's with his permanent head, you know, Mr. Jones. And so I really got my back up. I called Mum and Dad over to look after the kids and I said, "I'm going to Canberra. I'll show them who the minister can see." And that's what it was about. And I left the knickers in the ashtray, clean knickers. I took them purposely for Mr. Jones, the permanent head, just to say, "Up you, mate. Anytime I want, I can see the minister." You've got to flash the booty.
That's right. You can offer him stuff that the permanent head can't. All he's got is a piece of paper in his hand, isn't he? You've got something a lot more interesting.
Mr. Jones got the joke.
After some years later, you started a PR business. It was pretty successful.
Well, that was because Hawke wouldn't let me be what I wanted to be, was a ministerial assistant, researcher, speechwriter. That's where my heart was and that's where my training was.
Looking back now, what do you think the first signs were, Jan, of mental illness?
Well, things started to go bad at the end of the 80s. The 80s were a dream run. I mean, my PR business was thriving. We were doing all exciting sort of accounts. And it was just brilliant being married to the Minister for Tourism, being in there at such a seminal time. But then at the end of the 80s, John lost his ministry in a very, very inappropriate way. He resigned, and he's the last minister under the Westminster system to resign to take the fall for his public servants. And he did that, and it was very sad because he was walking away from a portfolio that he'd built up and he loved, and the industry loved him. So that was traumatic. He probably should have had grief counselling at that time. But then our son, a few months later, had a terrible accident up on Dunk Island, a spinal accident, and mother guilt. You know, we always feel we can protect our children, and so I started to feel this mother guilt.
Then really? Mother guilt? That wasn't in any way your fault.
I went to see a woman, a lovely young doctor, an Israeli doctor, who understood what I felt. She said she treated the mothers of the Israeli soldiers in Israel, in Tel Aviv, and she said the same thing. They weren't responsible for sending their children to war, but they still had the guilt when they came home damaged. You just do. You feel that you should be there for them. I mean, he was 26 and he was up on Dunk Island, but I still felt guilty that he'd had the accident. Then my... a cousin that I adored suicided, and my mother was very ill. It just all coalesced, the end of the 80s. And I'd been an amazing coper. Mothers cope, you know, we can do everything, but suddenly I wasn't coping. I'd be at a board meeting and my head would drop on the desk because I hadn't slept for a week. You know, I wasn't eating. I weighed 6 stone, dripping wet. But nobody was saying, "This woman has manic depression, bipolar." Other times I'd rush into my office, "We can do this, we can do that." And I was up with the stars. I was on a manic high, but nobody understood. I was told when I was depressed, just go and book in for a holiday. You need a holiday. But
then there was the day the bastard courier parked across your driveway. That was seen as incipient madness, but to me it seemed like a perfectly rational response under the circumstances.
I should have acted more rationally. You know, I shouldn't have kicked the car and I shouldn't have jobbed the courier.
There's this guy parked across your driveway.
Yeah.
You get the phone call your daughter's about to give birth. You're trying to go to your daughter and then this guy just won't get his car out the way until you apologise to him.
Arms folded with his manifest, doodling with his radio. "I'll apologise. I'll move when you apologise." And this just kept going on and on. In the end, I said, "You bloody well move," you know, and I kicked the car. And then my son, who'd had the spinal accident, was living with us. He came upstairs. "What's happening? What's going on?" And he said to the courier, "Come on, mate, be reasonable. Move the car." And the courier just pushed Johnny across the garage. And this kid was packing a lot of metal in his back to protect his damaged spine. And I'm the mother. You know, I just saw red. I just got the guy. And as he turned, I just... right hooked him.
You punched him?
Oh, yeah.
Whereabouts?
In the jaw.
In the jaw?
Yeah, I had him by the T-shirt and I punched him.
But
wouldn't you, if you were a man, wouldn't you just go away and forget about it? No, 5 o'clock that night, the coppers came and took me to the station and charged me for arrest, for assault and battery or something. I don't know. It was the Criminal Act. I was charged under the Criminal Act.
You pled guilty, though, but fortunately for you, Pat O'Shane was your magistrate.
Well, Pat O'Shane understood that it was just a bullying tactic, you know, and I was exonerated. I was found guilty but exonerated of all charges or something. I don't know, but I don't have a criminal record.
Isn't that nice?
He's still probably got a broken jaw.
Listen, Lou, I hope.
The Sydney Morning Herald, the Telegraph the next day said the headlines, "The day Jan kickstarted Trevor's car." I thought that was a nice one.
Jan Murray is here today. Her memoir is called Sheer Madness, Sex, Lies and Politics. You kind of came unstuck when you discovered that John had been unfaithful. How did you discover that,
Jan? I'll say at the outset I don't blame him because I wasn't emotionally there for him when he was going through his bad time. We had our son. You know, I was being all concerned with my son and not with John. And I think he just found somebody who cared enough to keep stroking his ego and telling him he was still amazing, although he was no longer a minister. But I found out because of magazines, you know, he was these women, they like to have a VIP in their clutches. And every photograph was this woman, very proprietorial grasp on my husband. And then the penny just dropped. But I was so emotionally unstable by then. I was in such a bad place that I just collapsed. I started bouncing off walls and, you know, clawing at the walls. I was in a really bad way. It was a total psychotic meltdown. And from then on, it was 2 years after that, I was still very emotionally, psychologically disturbed, in and out of clinics and psychiatric wards.
Did your medication help initially?
It numbs, but sooner or later you've got to face it. And it was only through a lot of beautiful friends up here in Brisbane and the Gold Coast and over there in Sydney. I had some lovely friends who helped me through. And I learnt cognitive therapy. I got off the medication. I don't take drugs, but, you know, if the drugs work for you, good, but I don't want them. I want to be able to control the thoughts, control the emotions, and the emotions control the moods. So when you've got this serotonin imbalance in your brain, just like people who have an insulin imbalance, you can't control your mood, but you can control your thoughts. So I'm very rigid with, I don't let myself go to the dark side. And it's not always easy because things happen in your life where, you know, you want to let go, but I daren't let go.
You attacked John with a pair of scissors. I know it's not easy to discern what your motives were under the circumstances when you're kind of off the rails like that, but do you think you wanted to kill him?
I don't think I did. I think I wanted to scare him. I don't know. I think I always knew he was much stronger than me. But it's blinding rage. And here's another point. I was, the week before I dropped my bundle, before I had this psychotic meltdown, I'd been on, what do you call it? It was roid rage. I had this terrible rash and they gave me, and I can't think of what the word is now, steroids, that's right. So I was on steroids, but when my kids took me that afternoon after I collapsed to a psychiatrist, he didn't ask if I was on any medication and immediately put me on the SSRIs. And I've since learned that that's a deadly, it's roid rage. So I think I was experiencing roid rage when I attacked John.
You attempted suicide at one point. It was awful business. How did you climb out of all that in the end, Jan?
The suicide, and I've been complimented by Professor Gordon Parker. He's head of the Black Dog Institute, and you notice in the back of the book I put the information for the Black Dog Institute, and he said I've really nailed that from the insider's point of view. It was a feeling that it's just the worst you can ever be, and all you see, you're down in this dark well and the only thing you see is the door into oblivion, and you just have to go through that door and nothing can stop you. And that's how it happened.
It sounds like you were lucky to have friends to pick you up and take you away from the door.
Yeah. I'd gone through it. I dedicate the book to Kathy Ray. She was a friend up there on the Gold Coast, and it was only that she was courageous enough to go up out on the roof terrace, because I was very close to death. I was defibrillated 3 times in the ambulance on the way to the Gold Coast Hospital. So I'd have died if Kathy hadn't have found me up on the roof that night.
You made a decision to just walk out of the house one night and to drive. just to drive.
To Queensland.
You drove up to Queensland. Yeah. Was that the start of your recovery, do you think?
Yes, it definitely was, because I'd made such an ass of myself in Sydney. I mean, it was a very, John and I were very high profile. It was a pretty high profile breakdown. And a lot of people that I thought were friends dropped me. Like, it's very embarrassing to know a nutter, and I was a real nutter, and they didn't want to know me. I realised there was no place for me in that world. I had to drop the old world, the gold pass, the travel, the husband and all that business.
That world isn't that great, you know.
No, I don't
miss it. It's not that great, that world, no.
No, I love the quiet life I lead now. But also I had to get out of my kids' way, because they had partners, they had careers, and I was a 24-hour job. You know, they had the watch on me 24 hours because Mum did crazy things when you let her out. So this day I knew I was sane. I knew the period between the manic highs and the shocking malignant sadness that is depression, I'd levelled out, and I thought, this is the moment to nip this thing in the bud. I've got to get over this. Got to stop being a drain on everybody. So I just got in the car and drove through the night and finished up in Queensland.
You've got a whole bunch of grandkids now. Yeah. How are things with you and John these days? Has it settled?
Oh, yeah, we're mates. You know, 13 grandkids, 5 kids. There's always some birthday or some drama. We get together. We live totally separate lives. He's still a minister in exile, I think. He still leads that sort of life. And I don't. I'm a bit feral.
Yeah, but you're still the little girl reading books in the backyard with the chooks, aren't you? I mean, because you're still studying, aren't you?
Yes. I'm going back, doing my MA this year. Yeah. In literature.
So not all that much has changed in one sense.
Except I don't have to frock up anymore. I can live on my boat or whatever I want to do.
Live on a boat?
Yeah, for years my friend and I have a beautiful old classic timber yacht, and we've refurbished it. We were both pretty damaged souls when I met him at Byron Bay, and just doing up that boat has been part of the healing process, and sailing the beautiful Whitsundays and swimming with the dolphins and the giant turtles. It's all been beautiful. It beats the crap out of being at a cocktail party in Canberra.
What an amazing life, Jan. We've really only touched on it, like, not even half the stuff in your book today, because there's so much there. What an extraordinary rich life, and it's going on in the same way. Lovely to have you here, Jan, today. Thank you so much for being
here.
Oh,
it's been amazing. Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.